Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. Angela Rasmussen, who leads the core virology team at the Center for Global Health, Science, and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. She's an expert on emergent pathogens like Ebola, MERS, and now SARS-CoV-2, COVID-19. She's a leading expert on what drives the expression of viruses in humans and talks about the importance of masking and getting vaccinated. Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program, Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. Angela Rasmussen here on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. Angela Rasmussen, who leads the core virology team at the Center for Global Health, Science, and Security at Georgetown University Medical Center. Her global renowned team centers on emerging pathogens like Ebola, MERS, and now SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19, focusing on genetic and other factors that drive severe infection in humans.
Dr. Rasmussen is a frequent contributor across the media landscape on the science behind COVID-19, from the effectiveness of mask use and vaccines, and also the threat of emerging variants. She also serves on the NIH Advisory Committee on Changing the Culture to End Sexual Harassment. Her work has been published in numerous journals, including Cell, Nature, and the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Rasmussen, we welcome you to Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Unfortunately, we have this grim milestone that the U.S. Reported this week. More than 400,000 Americans have died from COVID-19 since the pandemic began. The novel coronavirus, as it was first known, sent the global scientific community really into overdrive, trying to develop a consensus on what the pathogen was and how to contain it. You know, so many of our guests in this past year have said that this virus continues to confound and surprise them with unpredictability. And yet we've learned so much so quickly. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners as a leading virologist, what's your assessment? How formidable a foe is COVID-19, and where do you think we are in terms of the pandemic's trajectory?
Well, those are all excellent questions, and I think that we could probably talk about that for hours. But I think, you know, one of the things that I think myself and a lot of my colleagues were thinking about when the news that this was a coronavirus first came out about a year ago was how much it was going to be like SARS classic or MERS coronavirus. And this virus is different, actually, in two key ways, one good and one bad. The good part is that this certainly has a much lower case fatality rate than either SARS coronavirus or MERS coronavirus. So that's excellent news. Mm-hmm. But the bad news is that it's much more transmissible than either of those viruses. And unlike SARS classic, it can be transmitted and transmitted very effectively during the pre-symptomatic period. So when people don't know that they're sick. Unfortunately, because we were slow to respond and we responded with really half measures such as travel bans rather than focusing on increasing our testing and tracing capacity and focusing on the basic epidemiology that would have allowed us to control this from the beginning, right now where we're at is a situation of uncontrolled community transmission throughout mm-hmm. most of the US and in other parts of the world. And that means that with that pre-symptomatic transmission, and also no effective contact tracing or testing in many places, that people don't know when they're being exposed. They don't know that they're at risk potentially of transmitting it to others. And that has compounded and compounded as it has spread through the population. And that's really where we're at. But I think that the good news for the future of the pandemic going forward is that now we do have vaccines that have exceeded our wildest expectations in terms of their efficacy. So really now it's a race against the clock to see how quickly we can get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible.
You know, Dr. Rasmussen, as we've tried to make sense of this and to also help our patients and communities understand it, one of the more confounding things about the virus is that the way it seems to just, you know, deal a light blow, a glancing blow to many who become infected and yet send others into what we call the cytokine storms with very rapid decline. You've long studied the drivers of pathogenicity of viruses. You've developed mouse models looking at genetics and other drivers of how these emerging diseases spread. When we look at the collective science that we now can agree on, as well as your own research, what do you think are the most important drivers of both infection and severe disease with COVID-19?
Well, I can tell you from a molecular perspective or a cellular perspective, I think that what you just mentioned, whether a person goes into a cytokine storm or not, is clearly one of the most important factors in driving COVID-19 severity. And that probably has something to do with the speed and the robustness at which a person can mount an effective innate immune response. So we've seen both in patients and in mouse models that people who have more severe disease outcomes tend to have a diminished interferon response. An interferon is the innate antiviral pathway that it's sort of like a fire alarm and a sprinkler system all in one. It will detect that there's a viral infection there. It'll let other cells, including cells from the adaptive immune system, know that. And then it will begin secreting cytokines that bring in all of these other immune and inflammatory effectors to control the infection. When that doesn't happen at first, that results in a less effective adaptive immune response, and that also results in essentially uncontrolled inflammation. What we still don't really know is what predisposes a person to have that delayed response. And it's certainly genetic. It probably also has a lot to do with epigenetics, with how gene expression is regulated. It probably also has a lot to do with other comorbidities, medical status, potentially even diet and environmental factors. So it's really complicated. There's a lot of variables involved. We can model this, and that myself is something that I'm working on, something many of my colleagues are working on, trying to look at that using animal models, also using samples from patients. But ultimately, we still don't really have a very good idea about what predisposes a person to have those types of responses that cause severe illness.
Dr. Rasmussen, you know, we've had a number of guests on over the years. Over this last year, Dr. Fauci's been on a couple of times. And obviously, right now, I think people are focused in on this mutation or, you know, this new strain, the UK variant that's come up. I think we've heard from him and maybe others that coronaviruses, they're going to mutate. They're going to do things that's normal. Don't get worried. But we're all humans. We worry about this. And I'm wondering what your sense of this variant. Is the vaccine effective on it? Is it, you've said earlier, it's got more transmissibility. It may not be more deadly. Have we done the core studies to understand whether or not the vaccine is effective on it? What can you share with us?
So this is still very much an ongoing area of research, but the epidemiological evidence does suggest that both the B117 UK variant, as well as the 501Y.V2 variant from South Africa and the P1 variant from Brazil, are all more transmissible. And that's largely based on epidemiological evidence that those variants rapidly became dominant within a population, suggesting that they had some sort of advantage to outcompete other variants that were circulating within that same population. And Dr. Fauci's right, like we do expect variants to emerge, and it's not unreasonable to expect that variants would emerge that are more efficient at infecting a human host, because that's really what a virus is driven to do evolutionarily. Any type of virus that has an advantage in that way in finding a new host is probably going to be under positive evolutionary selection and will take over. In terms of immunity, I mean, that's really the million-dollar question right now. We really do need to know very quickly how well vaccines are going to work against these. And just today, new preprints came out suggesting that while the B117 variant doesn't appear to be a problem in terms of the vaccine, the mutations in the 501YV2 variant from South Africa are another story. And we should be concerned because several of these mutations have been shown to reduce antibody neutralization. So antibodies directed at those particular sites in the receptor binding domain of the spike protein, which is an important target for antibody neutralization, do not neutralize it as well or not at all. But the good news here is that when you have serum from somebody who's been vaccinated, they're not just making antibodies to the 501Y residue in the receptor binding domain. They're making antibodies for the entire spike protein. And the same study that showed that those particular mutations resulted in a loss of neutralization were still effectively neutralized by vaccinated sera. So the serum from people, the totality of the antibodies that they made against the spike protein in the vaccine were still capable of neutralizing at least pseudoviruses that contained that spike protein. So that suggests that even though there are these mutations that can escape antibody neutralization, overall, the antibodies are generating a response that's still protective. But one thing people should keep in mind is that we don't actually have good correlates of protection for vaccines right now. The bottom line here is that vaccines should probably still work against these new variants, but we do need to do more genomic surveillance to see other variants that might emerge in the future, especially as more people get vaccinated and there's going to be increased selection pressure on the virus to mutate further to evade those antibody responses that these vaccines produce. Again, we need to vaccinate as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, and keep looking at the virus to make sure we don't need to adjust the vaccines in the future.
Well, we have seen the arrival of the vaccines, the speed at which they were developed, the safety testing with which they were developed is really one of the few bright spots in this pandemic. There's still a lot of vaccine hesitancy, a lot of mistrust about the vaccine. Give us what you use as your best, both scientific and layperson argument for why the vaccine really is both safe and effective as we're trying to communicate this message out to people and get them to take advantage of the fact that the vaccines are here today.
It depends really on what people's concerns are, because there are a lot of different reasons, many of them justified for being hesitant to take these vaccines. I start usually by reminding people that these vaccines and the speed at which they were developed and their efficacy, which again has exceeded our expectations, is really one of the greatest scientific achievements of my lifetime. And we should really regard it as that. Getting deeper into it, I think it's really important that we engage with people with what their actual concerns are, and we should do so seriously. Certain aspects of vaccine hesitancy can be associated with these more extreme views, and often with people who are not going to be convinced that vaccines are safe or effective no matter what you say to them. I think we need to stop approaching vaccine hesitancy as if all people are coming from that space, because I think many people who are concerned about the vaccines really do have legitimate concerns. And for example, people want to know if these vaccines were developed so quickly, and this pipeline normally takes years and years or even decades, then how do we know that these vaccines actually do work and are safe? And how I explain that to people is just that we normally develop vaccines as a sequential process. So we start by spending a couple of years designing the vaccine, then we spend a couple more years testing it in animals, then we spend a couple more years doing phase 1/2 trials, then we finally spend a couple more years after that doing phase 3 trials that usually go for a lot longer because we're also looking at vaccine durability or the amount of time at which the vaccine can provide protection. In this case, we did many of those things at the same time. So the vaccines that are ahead in the race, the ones that already have authorization, are vaccines that can be designed using computers. So it doesn't take a long time to design them. It doesn't take a long time to manufacture them. We already had some data suggesting that mRNA vaccines are safe from other phase 1 trials that had been done before the pandemic. So we were able to move right into phase 1 clinical trials while doing the preclinical animal studies at the same time. Now, the phase 3 part of the process was done in a more rapid period of time because we decided not to look at durability. And that's really the one thing that's been sacrificed. So we still used tens of thousands of patients that would normally be used. The trial sizes for the phase 3 trials were the same. we just didn't look at durability, but that's still going to be looked at long term. It's not that we're not going to look at that at all, but the number of people that we looked at in the phase three trials is comparable, and that allows us to look at safety, at least short-term safety, within this time frame very effectively. We didn't really sacrifice anything. And using symptomatic COVID-19 as an endpoint for the trial, rather than looking at something like infection that may be harder to measure in asymptomatic people, allowed us to get efficacy data very quickly. So we really actually didn't sacrifice that much in terms of what we found out about how these vaccines work. Now, that's not the only form of vaccine hesitancy. Others are concerned about whether the vaccine is going to be safe for certain subgroups of people, and in particular communities of color, because historically those communities have been terribly exploited by biomedical researchers. And it's completely reasonable, I think, to be concerned that the vaccine is going to be, inappropriately tested or inappropriately used, and that those communities are going to bear the burden of that. And in addition to that, actually, I think that those communities are disproportionately affected by the pandemic because of disparities that exist due to racism. So I think that it's really important also to engage very seriously with those concerns, and in many cases to have trusted messengers. So people from their own communities, community leaders, church leaders, faith leaders, as well as physicians from within those communities, and nurses and other providers and scientific researchers, communicating exactly why those vaccines are more important for the higher risk communities to be taking than not, and that ultimately these vaccines save lives. It's really hard, and it's going to be a long uphill struggle. And some people are just saying, well, I'd rather wait and see. And sort of by necessity, most people are going to have to wait and see, because we don't have a sufficient supply to vaccinate everybody on demand right now. So I think that we need to be thinking about vaccine hesitancy as a longer term problem. What we really need to be thinking about right now at this moment is how we're going to improve distribution, because right now the demand greatly exceeds the supply, and the ability of vaccine suppliers like yourself, Dr. Flinter, to give the vaccine to everybody who wants it and everybody who needs it. So I think we need to be thinking about all of these things, but we also need to be thinking about what is the most urgent problem facing us right now, and that is vaccine distribution and supply.
We're speaking today with Dr. Angela Rasmussen, who leads the virology team at the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University. Well, it is January 20th. We have the 46th president who's been inaugurated. And really, he's called for a huge public health intervention over the next 100 days. And it's obviously the vaccine, the two that we have approved. But we also have wearing masks. For those who are hesitant, we remind them wearing masks, social distancing, and avoiding large crowds is very important. And I know you've certainly talked about the mask wearing. But I want to get back to the virus itself. It seems to me that this, I don't want to say the virus has a consciousness, but it seems like it's finding ways to survive, and that we've got to have more clinical trials that are going on. I take it on that first clinical trial, the durability test will still go on because that trial is going on. Talk about what other things are happening in the background, because I would assume that we want to do other types of trials, not only on vaccines to deal with the current genomic makeup of the virus, but we also want to look at all these others. Who's leading that? The pharmacy industry who are putting out these, but where in the scientific community they're saying, hey, wait, we need to start running some parallel studies to look at opportunities that might be in front of us?
Well, there are academic studies going on, as well as studies that are sponsored by the pharmaceutical industry. And when it comes down to testing products, whether they be vaccines or therapeutics, academic institutions are not capable of making a product that will be sold on the market. They don't have the manufacturing capacity. They don't have the regulatory resources, things like that. So ultimately, if you're talking about something that's going to be used for the public, unless it's something like convalescent plasma, that's not really a pharmaceutical product, you're really talking about making sure that you are partnering with a pharmaceutical company. But that said, you know, there are plenty of academic institutions that are running trials with existing drugs using things like, well, I hate to even mention it, but back when we were all talking about hydroxychloroquine, a number of different academic institutions were running clinical trials with that because it's an already available existing mm-hmm. generic drug. And in that context, you don't need a new manufacturer to make a new drug. You're just using something that's already there. And so you can test it out in your own medical center, doing a clinical trial with that. For new vaccines, all of them have a pharmaceutical partner because they will certainly need somebody to manufacture and distribute that vaccine, as well as to seek FDA approval, which is a very expensive and cumbersome process. So around the world, though, there are numerous trials going on for both novel therapeutics, repurposing existing therapeutics, and making new vaccines. And there are, you know, many vaccines that are at different places in the development pipeline. I think the last time I checked the tracker, there were over 300 different vaccine candidates. Some will only be available in certain countries. And so this is where organizations like the World Health Organization come into this. And I think that is something that hasn't gotten as much coverage here in the US just because our prior president expressed intentions to withdraw from the World Health Organization and did not participate in the COVAX group, which is a consortium of countries led by the WHO, by CEPI, and Gavi, which are two vaccine organizations, to develop vaccines and manufacture and supply them to the entire world. And this is something we need to be thinking about long term. It's not necessarily developing new vaccines, but it's figuring out how we can take the vaccine supply that we have, get it from countries, wealthy countries like the United States, and make sure that they are being equitably distributed worldwide. Mm-hmm. Because especially in places that don't have as much healthcare infrastructure, low and middle income countries that may not be able to purchase millions and millions of vaccine doses, it's going to be absolutely critical that we still find a way to get vaccines to all the people in those countries. Because this is a pandemic, and by definition, it's affecting the entire world. This isn't going to be over once we reach the herd immunity threshold in the United States. This will only be over when we reach the herd immunity threshold globally. So that I think is something that I'm hopeful that the new Biden administration will be more involved in, is really working with international partners collaboratively to make sure that everybody in the world can have access to these vaccines, because until all of us are safe, none of us are safe.
You know, Dr. Rasmussen, I'd be curious for your thoughts on what we've learned, right? I think back to the days in New York last spring, and your heart just goes out to all of our clinical colleagues who had so little tools to work with, you know, aside from all the worries about PPE and so forth. We just didn't know a lot about how to treat this. And my guess is that we have learned some very important things about how to treat cytokine storm and how to treat other overwhelming viral infections like that. And I wonder if you could, it's kind of a complicated question again, but both comment on what we've learned about the care of the individual and what we've learned about what we need to do as a public health community whenever a new threat like this arises down the road. Can you try and tackle that, or at least one of the two?
Yeah, I can try to tackle that in general. And it's probably going to have to be the latter question about preparedness, because I'm not a physician. I don't treat patients. And the only thing I can say about that is that it's clear from talking to my colleagues who are physicians, respiratory therapists, nurses, who are treating patients, that you know, we have come far in how we treat people who have severe COVID, at least. But really, we don't have a lot of really good targeted strategies. Our antiviral drugs are only really effective. They're kind of effective, but they have to be given as early as possible. And given that they're all delivered by IV infusion, it can be very difficult to do that at the time of diagnosis. We also don't have a sufficient supply to be treating everybody who tests positive for SARS coronavirus 2 with therapeutic monoclonal antibodies, for example. So, you know, that has been sort of a, it's been a disappointment that we don't have better antiviral therapeutics. In terms of treating the cytokine storm, a lot of the clinical trials for existing drugs that target specific cytokines, such as tocilizumab, which targets IL-6, which is a major pro-inflammatory cytokine, have really been also disappointing. They've really showed no effect or therapeutic benefit. The only thing that has is a really old drug, but that's also a very, very potent broad spectrum anti-inflammatory steroid, and that's dexamethasone treatment, which does have a significant mortality benefit, at least for patients receiving supplemental oxygen. So we've come a little ways, but we still have a long way to go, I think, in terms of translating what we know about the pathogenesis of COVID-19 into treatments that will be useful in the clinic and will be available to a lot of people who need them. I think, though, that in general, for public health and being prepared for other pandemics that will happen, because it's not a question of if, but a question of when. There are thousands of other circulating coronaviruses alone, plus there are 24 other families of viruses that can also have the potential to be human pathogens. And in a sense, we should count ourselves lucky that that something like this emerged instead of something like a more transmissible Nipah virus, for example, that has a much higher fatality rate. So we need to be prepared, though, for that disease X to emerge in the future. And that means basically increasing our investment in research across the board. And that's everything from basic research, surveillance, basic virology to understand better how these viruses work so we can try to find some of their weak spots, all the way up to translational things, looking at new vaccine platforms that could be used to generate new vaccines against a novel pathogen very rapidly. Things like, how would we potentially take mRNA vaccines, for example, and be able to start manufacturing them right away without necessarily needing to do a phase 3 clinical trial? How would we be able to speed up the process? And I think that, you know, the vaccine Operation Warp Speed, the expedited vaccine review process, does give us a starting point, at least for removing some of the regulatory roadblocks and red tape that sometimes get in the way of this. But ultimately, I mean, I think you can't always fix problems by throwing money at them, but you also can't do meaningful research if you don't have funding to support it. And historically, with coronaviruses anyways, but many other emerging viruses, when there is an epidemic of a novel emerging virus, and this is true for SARS, for MERS, and I hope it won't be the case for SARS-2, there is an immediate influx of funding as people are paying attention to the crisis. And so people drop everything and start working on these viruses, and then that money goes away. So they can't renew their grants. Any research they were conducting on the virus will stop because they can't afford to keep doing it. We really need to stop funding scientific research, especially that has important pandemic preparedness implications, with this boom and bust cycle of funding. If we really want to be prepared for the next pandemic, we need to make sure that we're doing the research before that virus emerges and not scrambling to find out about it afterwards. Well, and that means that we're going to have to make a significant investment without an expectation of a payoff, because that's the irony of pandemic preparedness research. If you're actually succeeding at it, then it looks like you're not doing anything because there's no new pandemic. So I would hope that people are, as they're more interested in science and viruses in general, which is a wonderful silver lining anyways of this pandemic for me, I hope that people will also remember this for some time to come and understand why we need to put more effort into preparedness measures like this.
We've been speaking today with the renowned virologist, Dr. Angela Rasmussen, at the Center for Global Health Science and Security at Georgetown University. You can access her many published papers and articles by going to angelarasmussen.org, or you can follow her on Twitter at Angie Rasmussen. Dr. Rasmussen, thank you so much for your tenacious efforts of your own and of your colleagues in uncovering the secrets of all these deadly global pathogens, your innate gift to making it understandable, and also for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Two COVID-19 vaccines are now authorized in the U.S. by the Food and Drug Administration. One vaccine from Pfizer and BioNTech, and another from Moderna. We'll take a look at how these vaccines work. Both the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna vaccines are mRNA vaccines that require two doses. The vaccines work by triggering an immune response against the spike protein of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. That spike protein sits on the surface of the coronavirus and is what the virus uses to enter cells. The vaccines are made of modified messenger RNA, or mRNA, wrapped in a special blend of fatty molecules known as lipid nanoparticles. The mRNA provides instructions for cells to make their own spike proteins, prompting the body to generate protective antibodies and activate T cells. The lipids help deliver the RNA into cells and prevent it from being degraded too quickly. The Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine includes 30 micrograms of mRNA in each dose. Moderna's shot has 100 micrograms. The two vaccines also use a different mix of lipids. As the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has explained, there is no way to catch COVID-19 from this type of vaccine because the vaccine is not made of a virus. And because the mRNA from the vaccine doesn't enter the nucleus, the part of the cell that houses DNA, it, quote, does not affect or interact with a person's DNA, the CDC said, contrary to some online rumors. The Moderna vaccine was developed in collaboration with the National Institutes of Health. Researchers at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases Vaccine Research Center were already working with scientists at Moderna on an investigational vaccine to protect against MERS, another disease caused by a coronavirus. As soon as the genetic sequence of SARS-CoV-2 became available in January, the team was able to apply that knowledge to design a COVID-19 vaccine. German company BioNTech designed multiple mRNA vaccine candidates after the genetic sequence of the virus became public in January and partnered with Pfizer in March. According to the results of the phase 3 trials, the two vaccines had an efficacy of 94% or higher, which approximately means your risk of getting sick from the coronavirus is cut by 94% or more if you are vaccinated. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Over the past few decades, kids have been getting less and less physical activity throughout the school day. And as budgets have been tightened and achievement requirements have increased, phys ed has become less prevalent in many schools. The University of Michigan researchers wanted to find a creative and effective solution that would increase kids' movement and increasing sedentary lifestyles without disrupting the school day.
We looked at the scientific literature in terms of prolonged sitting, and they have demonstrated that if you just 2 minutes of activity, a small burst, get up, do some movements, sit back down, activity in that small of a dose can have dramatic improvements on health, on cognition, on learning. So we decided to develop an intervention, a program that would allow children to get these small bursts of activity throughout the day.
Dr. Rebecca Hassan is principal investigator for IMPACT, Interruption of Prolonged Sitting with Activity. She wanted to find out if just 2 to 3 minute short burst of physical activity 5 times a day would impact the kids' cumulative movement. The research showed that kids of all shapes and body types found the program easy to participate in.
we typically see in PE or recess lower participation in girls compared to boys, but in classroom activity breaks, you actually see similar rates of participation, if not higher rates of participation in girls compared to boys. We also saw that for children who are carrying a few extra pounds, that those children also were exercising at a high intensity. Even children with asthma, they were even able to do the activity breaks at a higher extent than the children without asthma.
Dr. Hassan, a kinesiologist, said they wanted to design the intervention that would be easy for teachers to adopt and manage. So they created videos designed to get kids moving quickly, then allow them to quickly ease back into their learning mode.
We created a compendium of 200 activity breaks that are just 3 minutes long. So the teachers had a variety of different types of activities, whether it was jumping jacks, leapfrogs, something that will get their heart rate in the target heart zone. We got a lot of positive responses, particularly for the videos from the teachers, because it was really easy to implement.
Kids burned on average about 150 more calories per day, and at the end of the week had accrued a significant amount of physical activity.
The kids, when they left the laboratory, when they went home, they still continued to be physically active. We have these little accelerometers. They measure movement at the hip, and so it tells us how many calories were the kids burning away from the laboratory and how much physical activity were they getting.
A low-cost, easily adoptable fitness intervention for kids, allowing short bursts of physical activity throughout the school day. Enhancing fitness, empowering kids to move more, positively impacting the learning experience. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.